This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
The mystery of the outsider is irresistible to Americans. Beginning in the 1960s, a time period characterized by American cynicism and political dissent, and continuing into the alternative 90s, outsiders have constantly mesmerized white middle-class audiences. From Elvis Presley to Bob Dylan, Marlon Brando, James Dean, on and on, there is no denying that the bad boy and the bad girl, the rebel, the recluse, continue to be among America's most seductive icons. To help us understand why, and why especially it's something that we should be thinking about today when we follow the nightly news here in America, Grace Hale joins me, historian from the University of Virginia. Her new book is A Nation of Outsiders, How the White Middle Class Fell in Love with Rebellion in Postwar America. Grace, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So where does this book begin? You say postwar America. Do you pick it up right after World War II?
I do. I start right after World War II, and that's so that I can show a kind of shift that I think is really so profound, but because we're living inside of it, it's sometimes difficult for us to see. And that is the shift from a time period when the white middle class saw itself as a kind of universal every man and every woman, that they were America, they were the American way of life, to our time where I think many white American middle-class people see themselves as somehow alienated from something they see as dominating the social or cultural life of the nation that they're somehow forming themselves against. And that's really a profound shift in a way of thinking about how you fit into the world.
So, and yeah, absolutely. And as you point out in your book, this cultural shift had a dramatic impact on politics and the way we think about America, the way we think about our government and our place in the country. Tell us about this process and how you see it beginning.
Well, I think it really starts in the 40s and 50s as various groups and particular forms of popular culture begin to spread this kind of seductive outsider figure across the landscape. One key group of people, of course, would be the Beats, really early to this particular party, shall we say, really beginning in the 1940s, mid-40s. To see themselves as alienated from a kind of middle American mainstream, as they would think of it, culture, and to think of themselves as opposing that, even though they were themselves, for the most part, from fairly privileged backgrounds, and certainly all were they met attending Columbia University, which would suggest a certain level of privilege.
I was going to say you can't really get more in than, you know, Jack Kerouac playing football on the football field at Columbia University, you know, an all-white team and very privileged and, you know, money in his pocket to burn. And yet he came to consider himself as a complete outsider in America.
Well, he's an interesting figure because he really does come from a working-class French-Canadian family that had migrated into the northeastern United States. So he really does have a kind of background that makes him feel somewhat apart from the kind of white Ivy League middle class. You know, it's still a time when these schools are dominated by a kind of anti-Semitism and not even a hugely welcoming to Catholics. And so he was Catholic as well.
Yeah, good point.
He does actually have more of a claim on that than some of the other figures that he runs around with, for sure. But at the same time, still kind of generating a certain amount of that alienation, not feeling it so directly in his pocketbook.
We're talking with Grace Hale. The phone lines are open, 977-1070. The new book is A Nation of Outsiders, How the White Middle Class Fell in Love with Rebellion in Postwar America. So it was people like the Beats, the Beat Writers, the Beat Generation, which led to the Beatniks and then into the hippies, and they were all trying to mimic the one that came before. And yet the Beats also had some romantic notions about what came before them. They sort of romanticized the migrant worker and the homeless people in the Depression, right?
They certainly did. The kind of romanticization of the hobo riding the rails really is at the heart of their sort of desire to set out in sometimes stolen cars, sometimes cars they borrowed from friends, and see America really does draw on a kind of romanticization of what came before them. And also they are very important for creating a kind of romantic vision of people they see as different from themselves racially. Their encounters with African Americans in cities across the country and Mexican Americans and other Latinos in agricultural areas in California, small towns. They develop that kind of what Norman Mailer will later coin the term the white Negro to refer to. They really, in some ways, are a key moment in starting that kind of romanticization.
And of course, the very idea of the West was so critical to the Beats as they created this idea of themselves and the Beat generation. Were they rediscovering something like from the 19th century, some old idea of the American West?
Well, it is interesting the way that they put the car in the place of the horse or the wagon and take off. And that sense of limitless possibility in the West, possibilities for reinvention, they really do adapt that to a kind of 20th century sort of cultural understanding of reinvention as opposed to the pioneers in the 19th century's vision of setting up a new town, a new community, a new economy. It's a little bit different, but yes, based on that.
So we're talking with Grace Hale of the University of Virginia. The book is A Nation of Outsiders. So then what happened then? Because the Beats weren't romanticized and popular at first. They were cast out and looked down upon and criticized. When do you start to see this shift where, you know, white kids sitting at home, privileged kids, start to look up to them and romanticize this?
Well, I think you do have to have at least a moment to talk about rock and roll before you can quite get to the Beats becoming popular. But really that mid-1950s popularity amongst white teenagers of rock and roll, which they very much see as an African-American form of music. Musicologists can quibble about exactly what part of the music comes from where, but certainly the white teenagers that were fans of rock and roll in the early days saw it as very transgressive because of its connection to black people and to their fantasies of black people.
And early on, it was called Negro music, wasn't it?
It was certainly race music earlier, but when you have Presley, of course, when Presley hits the radio in 1954, that's really a key moment. The fact that he is white but sounds black, and especially in the early days, is adapting African American styles of clothing and hair, et cetera. You know, really adopting a kind of black visual image as well as sound is very, very powerful. And people see it that way at the time.
Yeah.
And that's part of the attraction. And that really helps to prepare the way for that later fame, late 50s fame of the Beats.
We're talking with Grace Hale. Just as a quick sidebar, that continues to this day. I mean, you see the mimicking of African-American rap stars among white middle-class kids with their hats turned to the side and the language that they choose to use in some occasions. It really is fascinating. You're seeing the teenagers of the 50s trying to look like Elvis.
Yes, and that was really particularly powerful, I think, in the late 90s with the white suburban kids, especially boys, into gangster rap.
Yeah.
Very powerful then. Very much a replay of that.
Right. The phone lines are open, 977-1070. Chris is on the line in Charlottesville. Chris, thank you for the call. You go right ahead.
Thank you, Corey, for taking my call. How are you doing?
Very good. Very good.
Good. And I'm sorry, what's the name of your guest?
This is Grace Hale. Yes.
Hello, Ms. Hale. How are you, Nick?
Fine.
Good. I'm a recovering drug addict for about 20 years, and I kind of left the culture that you're talking about, and I no longer participate in it. But I've been doing some reading over the past year or so, and one of the things that struck me was that the greatest generation, you know, the people that fought the Second World War for our country, they basically, in a large part, compared to their people in our country from before them, basically didn't think it was that important to go to church. And that's the first time, really, in this country that's the case. And in my mind, that contributes pretty substantially to the idea of, you know, people wanting to rebel against the society, rebel against the establishment, and that it gave them license to try to figure out how to invent the wheel, as you would say it. And also one more thing about the rock and roll. I understand where you're coming from. They rock and roll came out of blues, and Little Richard said that the blues had a baby, and they called it rock and roll. And what I've understood about it is that when the whites grabbed that music, that blues, they made it their own, and they changed it. And rock and roll became basically a white thing. It wasn't necessarily from the black community. The roots of it came from there, but it was not a black thing. Jimi Hendrix was really the only African-American that delved into that successfully, other than, the people from the 50s, like Little Richard and some
Chris,
of them.
Chris, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. There's a lot there to talk about. And, Grace, you want to begin with, the first point that he made or question was the degree to which religious observances dovetail or contribute in any way to this cultural transformation that you write about in your book.
Well, certainly, I haven't seen data really linking it to returning World War II veterans. I'm not suggesting our caller is wrong, but I haven't seen that kind of analysis. Certainly, church attendance does begin to drop a bit in America by the late 60s, by the mid to late 60s. But at the same time, one of the things I think that becomes so interesting is that to whatever degree the secularization of our culture does proceed in that mid 20th century period, religious folks really fight back, and they're able to see themselves as outsiders against what they see as a kind of secular popular culture. And that really begins to be, there's a little bit of that in the late 50s, but it really becomes powerful in the 1970s as a kind of pushback against the cultural changes of the 60s. And they're really able to see themselves in this oppositional, rebellious model and write themselves into that story and talk about their own alienation from the center of America. And they sound very much like they could be hippies from, a decade before when they're doing this. But they're coming from the perspective of conservative Christianity, quite frequently conservative Protestant fundamentalism. And I think that is really a part of the story that most people don't know.
We're talking with Grace Hale. The new book is A Nation of Outsiders, How the White Middle Class Fell in Love with Rebellion in Postwar America. That's exactly where I was going next with this subject, because I find it so fascinating how we see the birth of the romantic outsider, the romantic rebel, that really starts to take shape then in politics, both on the right and the left, to you get to the point today where the right and the left are, they both feel so completely alienated and outside of the mainstream, and it just makes you wonder, well, then where is the mainstream then? And I laugh like when people, radio hosts get on and they talk about the mainstream media as if they're not the mainstream media without millions of people listening to them.
Yes, it does make you to think maybe from a certain perspective to claim to be the absolute center would be the most transgressive position. But this really does begin very powerfully in the late 60s and 70s as a group of people come out of the counterculture and really rediscover conservative Christianity. This is an important moment in developing a kind of what I call the right-wing rebels or the rebels on the right, and they really see themselves as rebelling against the kind of watered-down liberal faith of the mainline Protestant churches that they've grown up with, or even Reformed Judaism that they've grown up with, and they see themselves going back to the early church and the purity of the early church.
And it's much more than just a backlash against the hippie 60s, right? I mean, there's a lot more going on here.
People really are, you would look at them and think they're hippies. They're being baptized in their bathing suits on the beach in California. They're donning what they call Jesus garb, dressing in robes that they think look like something that Jesus and his followers would have worn back in time, and walking around, proselytizing, carrying crosses, huge crosses on their backs. they're known as the Jesus freaks, but they're really countercultural in some ways with their sort of emphasis on emotional intimacy and personal kind of intimacy. But on the other hand, they're putting forward a very conservative theology.
Yeah. Before we let you go, is there a danger to any of this? I mean, you can see this sort of taking shape in post-war America. We see it now very much so in the politics of America, both on the right and the left. Is there some danger to this that we should keep in mind, this constant emphasis on, you know, you're not in the mainstream. Everybody is an outsider. Everybody is a rebel.
Well, I think that the shift to a very cultural understanding of alienation and what it means to be a rebel or an outsider has really made it very easy for many middle-class white Americans not to see the material or economic underpinnings of their own lives or the lives of others, that these things, once they're cast into cultural and social terms, really lose some of that connection to material and economic terms and what you know, sounds very old-fashioned today, but class status. So for middle-class people to see themselves as so aggrieved and put upon is to make it difficult for us to see the people who are extremely poor in our society, the people who are disfranchised in different ways, the people who really are suffering a kind of material alienation from
the
our
the people
culture.
Who are truly put upon.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm trying not to say are true, not to suggest that one sort of way of being alienated is more real than the other, but they are different. And it does make many middle-class Americans see, to some degree, to see these choices as cultural and moral choices when, in fact, not everyone has the choices that they have.
Yeah. They come at this from a place of privilege.
Right.
And they always really have since the 50s. You know, I'm the outsider. I'm up against the wall here. Everybody's out to get me. And yet you're incredibly privileged when you look at the people, you know, who are truly struggling in this country and you could argue are a lot more outside than you are.
So there you have George W. Bush running as an outsider when he's gone to Yale and Harvard and his dad is a president. I really don't think you can sort of encapsulate the shift I'm talking about more powerfully than that.
The book is A Nation of Outsiders, How the White Middle Class Fell in Love with Rebellion in Postwar America. Grace Hale, historian at the University of Virginia. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.